Good evening. I'm Stephen. Great pleasure to be giving a talk this evening. I'm part of the team that leads our Thursday evening drop-in classes. Maitri Ghosha Manjurava and Maya might be here. My friend at the back as well. And pardon?
Whatever it
is. And so you're sort of, those of you who are participating in the urban retreat are kind of joining us this evening to do what we usually do, which is have a Dharma discussion. But there's probably too many of us to have a discussion this evening. So I'm going to give more of a talk, but I'm hoping that I don't go on too long. And at the end, there'll be a chance for us to have some discussion. Maybe more of a question and answer type discussion. Anyway, the theme of your urban retreat is Blazing Like the Sun. And this talk is called Freedom of Heart. So we've got two metaphors, really, both describing metta, love, or loving kindness in the Buddhist teaching. So with the title Freedom of Heart, I wanted to explore the Buddha's teaching on metta. Firstly, to let you know, really, to say a bit about what the Buddha said about metta, and to link it up with how we practice metta bhavana in our meditation classes in the Tri Ratna tradition, which is slightly different. And to talk about that a bit. I think it's an interesting topic. I want to be quite down to earth, though. So what I'd like to do to start with is just introduce some words, really. Words are very important things. The words we use affect how we think. They affect how we label our experience. So exactly the kinds of words we use to describe our experience can have an effect. Anyway, I also am very keen on the Pali language, which is the language in which the Buddha's teaching has been recorded. So I like to introduce Pali words. So this phrase, freedom of heart, it's a translation into English of this phrase, metta chaito vimutti, in Pali. Metta chaito vimutti, which is to say, metta is chaito vimutti, which I'm initially calling freedom of heart. But these words don't translate straightforwardly at all. I want to sort of bring out a bit the range of meanings that we might find in these words, because I think it's important. So how do we normally translate this word metta? Loving kindness. Let's think, I'll do a bit of brain storming, writing up, because loving kindness. Is that a familiar phrase outside the Buddhist centre, do you think? So Maitri Ghosha says no. What do you think? Do you ever hear it spoken? Does anybody ever talk about loving kindness? Never, yeah.
If they do, you know they're a Buddhist.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's what I mean about words, yeah? Sometimes the words we use can be part of a sort of jargon that only we understand. And that can sort of somehow sometimes mean we don't really connect more broadly with what these words mean. So in the Buddhist time, metta wasn't a big piece of jargon. It meant, it comes from the word in Sanskrit, mitra, which you will know, I suppose, from our Tri Ratna tradition as meaning friend. So metta means the quality of being a friend, or I suppose I should say the quality of being a mitra. That's what metta means. So I could write friendliness, do you think? Friendliness is, as it were, when I say literal meaning, it's always a dangerous word to use in talking about translations. But metta also means friendliness. This word loving kindness, by the way, this phrase, I think it was introduced by Victorian translators because it translates a Hebrew word from the Bible. I wish I could remember my Hebrew. Unfortunately not. Which describes that God's mercy, as it were. It can be described as a kind of loving kindness. And I think it's translated like that in older versions of the Bible. Which is why we've got this this phrase. That's why they used it. Because they thought, oh, the best way to translate these Buddhist terms is in a biblical word. Yeah. So loving kindness. The kind of quality of love that God has. But of course, you're not great Bible readers. So you didn't recognise it, perhaps. But, you know, thinking a bit more, has anybody else got any other kind of words that they use to translate metta?
Goodwill.
Goodwill. This is important.
Which sounds really
awkward
now, doesn't it?
Now you've
mentioned the Bible.
Goodwill. Actually, universal love. I like goodwill.
Yeah.
Universal love. Any others?
Well-wishing.
Oh, lovely. I'm going to put that there, because do you think it means something like goodwill?
Unconditional love. That has to be explained, unconditional.
Yeah, we often say that, don't we? That metta is unconditional love. And partly we say that because the Buddha used an expression like that. He said it was unbounded or unlimited. Which is kind of what we mean a bit when we say unconditional, that it's not a love which has limits or conditions attached to it. Unconditional love.
Brotherly.
Ah, brotherly. Well, I don't know what the gender-neutral version of that would be. Siblingish. Yeah. Which is the kind of. How would you explain that, Subhadra?
Well, you've got kinship with somebody.
Yeah.
But you're both still independent.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a kind of love which is we expect or experience between close family members. Perhaps is the basis. In a perfect world. Yeah. No. But this is the thing, isn't it? That these words are important. But what the words we use, because for different people there's different resonances, isn't there? It depends on what's gone on for you. What do you think of the word love itself? If we just said love, do you think we can use that to translate metta?
A lot of people means romantic love.
It's a problem, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's associated with romantic love, which is rather exclusive.
Yeah.
I think there is expectation in love, without the expectation.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So there's this word love, perhaps because of the connection with romantic love, is we associate it with certain expectations for someone being there for you and so on.
Or rather superficial, like.
Pardon?
Cheese. Superficial as well, like cheese or like.
Oh, yes. We use the word love to designate a positive disposition. That's the philosophical way of putting it. As well as to name passionate attraction. So it's a very broad word, love, isn't it?
If you want to use prema, then you could use love.
Ah. So Suddhamma has mentioned this word prema, which is, we commonly translate affection, yeah? But really, we best translate it love, actually. So there's a case for just not translating the word metta and getting used to it, as it were, in the original language, I think, because we don't have one single term to translate this word. But please forgive me if I slip into just using the word love, because I'm used to that. Does that make sense? I've got this. I tend to think of metta just meaning love. But you can, you know, that's just a word to translate metta. So the Buddha described metta as chaito vimutti. Now, maybe I should do the same thing. Because, well, let's start with vimutti. I've said it means freedom. Freedom. But this word freedom in English is a bit ambiguous. When you hear about freedom, what do you think of? If I was to say, I'd like freedom.
Human rights and yeah. Speech.
Yeah. In contemporary English, the word freedom is associated with our rights, being able to say what we want without being told what the limits are on that.
Freedom from responsibility.
Freedom from responsibility, yeah. I want to be free to do what I want, whenever I want.
It's freedom from restraints.
Yeah.
Freedom from restraints. Right. I was going to contrast this kind of freedom to do what I want with that. So you've spoiled that line of thought. But I think actually they run into each other. That's the problem. So the word freedom in English, if I write freedom, it's got this kind of ambiguity. It can mean being able to do what we want, not having responsibility. But it can also mean simply, how did you put it? Freedom from restraints. Which doesn't necessarily mean you're free to do what you want, but you, as it were, if one was a prisoner, you know, you lack freedom. You've had your freedom taken away, and if you're released from prison, you're freed from the restraint of being in prison. That doesn't necessarily mean you can then do whatever you want. So, just to put that in context, what the Buddha was talking about. I think in the Buddha's day, the Buddha and people in his time didn't have a conception of freedom in the sense of being able to do what you want. In a traditional society like that of the Buddha, there wasn't any such possibility. Except if you left home, went into the forest and lived as a renunciant. So then you were free to do what you like. But in another sense, that's a very demanding lifestyle. It's not quite a hippie ideal, is it? So what the Buddha meant by talking about metta as freedom was more like a freedom from certain limitations or restraints that I suppose we quite ordinarily experience. I was thinking in meditation about what other words we might use for freedom.
Liberation.
I think that's a good one. What other words might we use for an experience of no longer experiencing the limitations that we are all too familiar with?
I would say rebirth. In India, you know, when maniacs aren't touchable, they can already into the Buddhism.
Yeah.
They use rebirth word rather than freedom. Because they were free from the caste system.
Yeah. So, rebirth. That's tricky to use. Yeah.
Reborn? You mean reborn?
Yeah, they were saying that they were in the hell, you know, when they were in the
house. Yeah, yeah.
So when they're adapted to this, they feel like it's like him or there. It's like something new.
Yeah, I suppose the word liberation does some of that work. Yeah.
New life.
Pardon?
New life.
New life. That's lovely, yeah. Ease. Oh, release. Was that another one?
Spontaneity.
Okay, yeah. So we've got a lovely crop of words there. Liberation, ease, release, new life, spontaneity. Which are all the kinds of words which we could use. This is the, as it were, what the word vimutti is getting at. Again, we don't have exactly one word in English, so it's worth knowing the range of words. But what is there liberation of? This is the next question. What's this word chaito? What is it that's liberated, as it were? And this word chaito is the same word as chitta, which you might have seen.
Heart.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we've been talking about freedom of heart. But the word heart in English, what does that signify?
Emotion.
Tends to signify the emotional centre, doesn't it? But the word chitta is much broader. So the word chitta has the sense not just of heart, but mind. Has a sense of, what did you say, Lee?
Clear conscience.
Clear conscience. Well, I suppose that might be a translation for the whole phrase. I suppose for the moment I'm trying to explore how this word chitta, it doesn't mean just heart. And it doesn't just mean mind either. It's a word that we really don't have an equivalent of in English. If I wanted to tell you about my chitta, yeah?
Can I just ask, is chaito, is it linked to chaitana? Is it linked to sort of...
It's exactly the same root, but the word chaitana means intention.
Yeah.
So it's got a very different meaning in Pali. Yeah. Pardon? Soul. There's a tricky word in English. The word soul has got associations through Christian theology and doctrine with the immortal part of our being, which has come into existence.
Poetry.
Pardon?
We talk about more in poetic terms, like sometimes it's referred to just as mind, heart, intellectual part.
Yeah, I suppose what I meant with the word soul is if we're going to use it, it's quite important that we don't suppose that it signifies a non-physical, immortal essence. Because in Buddhism, there's no such thing. Which might be a disappointment, but that's how it is. So we've got these words, heart, mind, soul. Chitta means all of them, really. I suppose it means the conscious centre of our being. That which feels, that which thinks, that which intends. Which is how, this is the connection with Chaitanya.
Sometimes we translate chitta as in consciousness, isn't it?
That's right. So I'm going to write consciousness as well. So again, we've got these various words which can all be used in different circumstances to translate chitta. So, when the Buddha said that metta was chaito vimutti, and we say that love is freedom of heart, well, you can see that that phrase in English might pin the meaning down far too much in certain ways. If you see what I mean. We could also say, as a translation, we could also translate this phrase, metta, chaito vimutti, as goodwill is release of consciousness. That doesn't work so well, does it? Or goodwill is liberation of the soul. That's quite nice, isn't it? It's quite important to find where you know what words work for you in thinking about these ideas. So with all that in mind, I want to sort of move on to explore what the Buddha actually meant by teaching this Chaito Vimutti. So there's lots of ways in which the Buddha characterised our experience as being limited or restrained or not, in a way, not liberated, not free. And I think quite a simple way to think about that is in terms of views and emotions. Just in our ordinary experience, you might notice that sometimes you find yourself unable to break out of a certain view you hold about yourself or other people. You're in a situation and you just get irritated. You react to a situation because of a view you hold. Or it could be that emotionally you discover that your likes and dislikes just keep causing you to not be able to relax into what's going on. You keep coming up with judgments, not wanting to be there, or getting over-involved because of views and emotions. So in this way, our experience is not necessarily liberated. We experience ourselves as unliberated. And it's in this sense that the Buddha recommended the practice of metta to move towards Chaito Vimutti, some kind of freedom or openness, you could say, of consciousness, of the heart, of the mind. And in fact, I'll read out there's a kind of standard description of the practice of metta in the early discourses of the Buddha. This is how the Buddha recommended doing metta bhavana. He simply said, "One lives pervading the first direction with an attitude of metta, then the second, the third, and the fourth." So one pervades all the directions, as it were. So you're sitting meditating, I think, is the implication. And you pervade the directions with an attitude of metta. One lives totally pervading the whole world, above, below, around, and everywhere, with an extravagant, magnificent, boundless attitude of metta, without hostility and without ill will. It's lovely, isn't it? So we find this passage quite often in the early discourses. It's a sort of standard passage in which the Buddha describes how to practice metta. This is very simple, isn't it? It's a very simple description, but also it's incredibly idealistic. You just find a quiet place, you sit down, and you pervade all the directions with a heart of loving kindness, of metta. I don't know about you, but I find that difficult. It's not always easy to do that. Which I'm going to explore that a little bit more in a bit. But I thought I wanted first to talk about how this teaching of metta in the early discourses is very clearly part of how the Buddha was talking about enlightenment or awakening. Sometimes this is not very clear in books you might read about Buddhism. It looks like the Buddha's teaching of awakening or enlightenment was some kind of intellectual realization. This word insight is often used to describe what it is that the Buddha essentially realized, liberating insight. And of course there is an intellectual dimension to the Buddha's enlightenment. It's very clear that he had a clear seeing and knowing of the true nature of things. But that's the intellectual dimension of a much bigger experience, and the emotional dimension, as it were, which is just as important, you might say, is expressed in terms of metta, in terms of this liberation or release of the mind, heart, soul. This liberation means that one is no longer closed, as it were, limited by views and emotions. So I'm saying all this to remind you or make the point that this teaching on metta is not like simply a technique for sort of cheering yourself up or cultivating the heart in order to move towards an intellectual sort of realization or awakening. It's actually a description of what it's like to be awakened. The idea of metta as freedom of heart, Chaitavamutti, is a description of the emotional aspect of awakening. You could also talk about a volitional aspect, by the way, but that's another topic. That would be how we act. And actually, the way a Buddha acts is in terms of compassion, in terms of helping others. Different topic. So, with all that in mind, this is tremendously idealistic, isn't it? The Buddha teaches metta bhavana in this sense of pervading the directions, but doesn't really give any more specific instructions than that. So now I can get on to why we do a particular kind of practice of metta bhavana in our tradition. So you're familiar with our five stages of the metta bhavana. Now this technique, as it were, it actually goes back a long way. We find it in the in a work called the Visuddhimagga by Buddhaghosa. He's a 5th century AD commentator in the Theravada tradition. So he was writing 1,000 years after the Buddha. And it's clear that Buddhists in that time, between the Buddhist time and Buddhaghosa's time, they had wondered, how do we practice this metta bhavana? It sounds good, but it's we need a way to practice it, a structure. And hence this 5-stage technique. First, you cultivate metta towards yourself, then towards a good friend, then towards a neutral person, then towards a difficult person, and finally, in the 5th stage, you move towards pervading the directions with loving kindness, with metta. So the form of metta bhavana we do is as it were a way of practicing the Buddha's teaching, working up to it. I'm giving a talk which is based on several other talks. So I've got a kind of lot of notes from several different talks. And I have to find where I'm going to go next. That's it. Good. And I think sometimes it's said, or one gets the impression, that the first 4 stages are like a preparation for the 5th stage. Has anybody had that impression? Samudragosha is nodding. And I think to a certain degree you can see that that's the case. That you cultivate metta towards yourself, a friend, neutral person, and a difficult person, as it were, to work up to the 5th stage of universal, all-pervading, unlimited loving kindness. But I want to make a case. Now, this is where I'm getting on to some more practical points. Make a case for the 5 stages having a lot more value than that. That in a sense, we can relate to the stages as we practice them as being each offering a certain sort of insight, a certain sort of element of the full experience of awakening, the emotional aspect of awakening. So in this sense, our 5-stage model technique is really quite valuable. Oh, just before I get onto this, I suppose one important aspect of talking about how our five stage technique relates to the Buddhist teaching is it makes it quite clear that it's just a technique. It's really important in our practice that we explore meditation in ways that work for us. So knowing that this is simply a technique, you can experiment. You're always free to experiment. Perhaps with the idea that the end, the ideal, as it were, is this all-pervading metta bhavana, this all-pervading loving-kindness. So in the first stage, we're encouraged to practice metta towards ourself, to extend goodwill or loving kindness towards ourselves. And this is something that you might find quite straightforward. But I think for most of us, at one time, some time or other, we find this not being very easy. Not being very easy. On a certain level, it's quite easy to say to ourselves, may I be well, may I be happy. But when it comes down to it, we notice that there's not just resistance, but unwillingness or difficulty. And I want to suggest that the first stage, a way to relate to it in terms of how it participates in the whole idea of awakening, is that it gives us the chance, the opportunity to notice that, or to practice with the idea that we aren't necessarily everything that we shouldn't believe everything we think about ourselves. Often we've got views about ourselves. A lot of our personality is the result of our upbringing and our childhood. That's just how it is for us human beings. And when we sit and try to practice loving kindness towards ourselves, we come up against that pretty quickly as we settle into some sort of awareness of our underlying views and emotions. We find how we've been formed, our attitudes towards ourselves. And at this point, we do ourselves a fantastic favour. We do ourselves the most marvellous thing by just sitting with an acceptance of what we find. If just for a few minutes we can drop our judgments about what we find in our experience, we give our whole body mind, as it were, the chance to start to look at things afresh, to not be limited by what we've been made, as it were. And in this sense, it's really important to bear in mind that metta isn't necessarily a nice, warm feeling. Might be, it's great when it is, but essentially, and this is where the translation goodwill is really important, it's the wish. Metta is more than anything the wish. May I be well. I mean, that could be a more or less heartfelt wish. It might be a thought, might be more like a heartfelt wish. But it's not necessarily a feeling. Because sometimes we just don't feel that good, do we? We might be really up against difficult emotions. But if we can just have this wish, may I be well, that can have a tremendous effect. It can initiate a kind of healing process. I think I personally have experienced tremendous healing through practicing metta bhavana. Something I've had to explore over the years is that when I was a very small infant, just born, I was in an incubator for a bit and didn't have any contact with my mum. And in the 60s, this is quite normal sort of childbirth practice. But actually it has the effect of meaning that young infants just don't form a sort of a bond straight away with their mothers. And sometimes I've dropped into in the past a sort of universal feeling of isolation. A very painful sense of just not being connected. And I think it just goes back to that kind of infant experience. And you can't do anything about it, as it were, because it's just part of my experience. And I'm sure everybody here has got their own version of some such experience. But just holding this wish, may I be well, can introduce a sense of, well, right now here as an adult, I can wish myself well, whatever I feel. And it starts to recreate a sense of being able to completely accept what's happening without necessarily making it into anything more difficult than it needs to be. And so this first stage of the metta gives us the opportunity to develop a kind of strength, I think, which is tremendously useful in the world, at beyond, as it were. People will pick up that you're somebody who knows themselves, accepts themselves, as it were, wishes themselves well. People will really notice that and benefit from it. So then, in the second stage of the metta bhavana, we turn our attention to a close friend, somebody who we very much love and appreciate. And I think usually, for most of us, this is not such a difficult stage. As long as we've got some friend in our lives, we can bring them to mind and find a sense of warmth and well-wishing, actually, towards this friend. And I think this is why the Buddhist tradition, why Buddha Gosa and the Visuddhimagga included this stage, because it gives us quite a straightforward way to access some aspect of metta. But the thing is, even with our close friends, we don't always get what we want. And I think practicing metta bhavana gives us the opportunity to notice something about our friendships. Sudama was talking about this word prema, or affection, or love. Now, this is generally regarded as what we call the near enemy of metta. It's something that looks like metta, feels like metta, smells like metta. Probably doesn't smell like metta. But actually, it's a sort of enemy. It's the kind of love which is very positive, but then if that person does something which doesn't suit you, it turns into something else, which is something like, how dare you do that? Maitri Ghosha. No, it's useful just to look at you when I'm saying a few years ago, I had a very good friend, Ratna Vuha, some of you will know him, who I was very close to, actually. And he decided to go to Australia. In fact, he decided to go to Australia in pursuit of romantic love. And I had very mixed feelings about that whole thing. What was he doing? He was leaving. My close friend was leaving, and I was going to really miss him. And it gave me the opportunity to see the aspect of affection and attachment in that friendship. Affection and attachment, even in the most positive relationships and friendships, can, as it were, be something that is present. Perhaps it's natural, and yet it's not the same as real metta. So metta, universal loving kindness, is unconditional. That's its nature. And this second stage of the five-stage model, when we bring to mind a close friend, gives us the chance to look into our relationships, our close loving relationships, and just find out how much attachment of a sort of clinging sort is there, how much affection is present, which isn't very open to change. And we can find that it gives us the chance to let go. Letting go is the great Buddhist message, in a way. It's all we can do, in some ways, is let go. Actually, of course, a love which is able to let go is so much more attractive to other people. Yeah, if you've ever been in that kind of dynamic with someone where you're both wanting something and you're able to let go, it takes the whole relationship into a new dimension, really, of trust and of actually being proper human communication. So I'm suggesting that this second stage of metta bhavana isn't just preparation, but it gives us a sort of working ground for practicing with metta in loving relationships. Third stage, metta towards a neutral person. I think this is a very beautiful opportunity to take our attention beyond our usual circle of concern and to feel our way, as it were, into how we're part of a much bigger reality of living beings, of human beings and living beings, all wishing for happiness in their own ways. I'm going to read a bit of poetry. This is from back of there. This is from William Wordsworth, one of my favourite poets, from a poem called The Old Cumberland Beggar. Wordsworth is describing this beggar, or tramp, we might say, or vagrant, or homeless person. And he's wondering, why do people give stuff, give food to somebody who won't work, who just wanders around? And he has this thought, this is Wordsworth, has this thought: man is dear to man. The poorest poor long for some moments in a weary life when they can know and feel that they have been themselves the fathers and the dealers out of some small blessings, have been kind to such as needed kindness for this single cause, that we all of us have one human heart. We all of us have one human heart. I think he's really put his finger on something, as Wordsworth there, that we actually want to be kind to people because it enables us to connect with this sense of common humanity, which is just a deep truth about the whole situation. It's no fun being completely selfish, is it? Being locked up into our own worlds. It's just a truth that you see or you don't, I think. To be open to other people, to be part of the human race, is a kind of good in itself. Nevertheless, these neutral people for whom we feel this common humanity, you might think, well, why don't we always feel that? And back in the summer, I had this experience of going to a conference, a Buddhist studies conference, actually, and I had my computer stolen. I left it in my rucksack. It was in a place I thought was secure, and somebody nicked my computer and my wallet and my phone. And it wasn't one of these Buddhist academics, I don't think. It was somebody else. It was a neutral person, was it not? A neutral person came and stole my stuff. And isn't that how it is? It's neutral people that steal things. And this is the reason that we're untrusting, isn't it? Usually. So there's good reasons, in a way, why normally our attitude to neutral people is like on this side of trusting. So we need some wisdom. I think this is where the third stage is. It invites us into a certain sort of human wisdom. And this wisdom is very nicely expressed in a Sufi story. A man rides his camel to the mosque, gets off his camel, goes into the mosque to pray. When he comes out, the camel is gone. The camel is gone. He is very angry at God or Allah. But the Sufi mystic who happens to be nearby, I suppose that's Rumi, isn't it? He gives them some sage advice. Trust in Allah and tether your camel anyway. Trust in Allah and tether your camel anyway. Did you get that? Didn't get that?
No.
Didn't get that, okay. Okay, so it's a really good thing to recognise one's common humanity with neutral people. But nevertheless, those very people, you don't know if actually you can trust them. They might steal your computer. They might go off on your camel. So it's very important not just to trust that everything's going to be fine because you're a nice person and you're able to practice metta. You need to combine that with a sort of worldly wisdom about when it's appropriate to tie up your camel, to not trust people, and so on. But this is important, isn't it? Having a sort of boundary, holding boundaries, which are in themselves boundaries that are based on metta and wisdom.
Can I just say something?
Of course.
I always think that third phrase that you're talking about
Yeah.
is very well shown in that film Groundhog Day.
Yeah.
If you know it.
Yeah.
Where basically the main character ceases to see people simply as tools for his own satisfaction and happiness.
Yeah.
And gradually comes to see them as actually people in their own right.
Yeah.
And I really think that that's what this phrase is all about. People are not just put on the earth to make our lives convenient.
Yeah.
They have a life, they have an agenda, they have a meaning all of their own.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
a lot of the time we're blind to it. So it's our opportunity to wake up as the character.
So another way to approach this third stage is a way of exploring how other people also have their own ends and desires, and we can recognise that. I suppose that film's based on the idea that the main character is extremely selfish. So it depends.
Like us.
Yes. Well, it kind of depends, doesn't it? Depends exactly where we are on that spectrum. Yeah. When you practice weekly cake giving, which I must say is very very unselfish. So then, in the final stage, we practice loving kindness towards a difficult person. And I think this one perhaps is the one that gives most people. Well, it's the most difficult, isn't it? For the obvious reason that we're bringing to mind a difficult person and trying to wish them well. I think it's really important to bear in mind here that in the teaching on this by Buddhaghosa from 1500 years ago, he didn't actually suggest that we should be finding positive love towards a difficult person. He simply suggests that the ideal is to relate to them like a neutral person. Does that make sense? So we transform, as it were, our feelings of hatred, if there might be such feelings, or irritation, or dislike, into simple neutrality, which is to say we just see the difficult person as another human being. And I say that because I think it might make your lives a lot easier to know that in the fourth stage, you're not trying to love someone you don't like, which is really difficult and perhaps even not very realistic. And I think it's very interesting that the Buddha, was... You can find examples of all these stages, in a way, in the early discourses, in stories. And on this one, there's a lovely story that the Buddha, he once was staying with some monks in a place called Kosambi, or he visited them. Now, I think he was staying there. Anyway, they got into this argument amongst themselves, these monks at Kosambi, about a very small thing, but they become totally polarised and fell out. And the Buddha, being the Buddha, stepped up among them and said, "Monks, can I help you sort this out?" And they said, "No. No, we just want to carry on arguing. So thanks very much. No." And at this, just imagine, you're an enlightened being, yeah? There's no one more capable of you than sorting out a bunch of arguing monks. They don't want to know. So what did the Buddha do? He said, "Okay." And he left, yeah? He left and went into the forest. And he went into the forest because it's wrong to say he was fed up, because I don't suppose Buddhas get fed up. But I think it's appropriate to say something like, he wasn't enjoying that experience. He wasn't enjoying it. He had a better idea about how to spend his time. So he went to the forest to be on his own. Actually, in the forest, he teamed up with a bull elephant. Those of you who know this story might have. This poor old bull elephant had been having a very difficult time in the herd. The she elephants had been jostling him. The baby elephants had been stealing his leaves and water. So he too was not enjoying herd life. And he went into the forest to be on his own. And they got together, the Buddha and this bull elephant, looked after each other. Anyway, the point is that with difficult people, we're not suggesting that, not only we're not suggesting you have to love them, but sometimes the best thing to do is to leave the situation alone. Yeah, sometimes it's worth bearing in mind that the Buddha didn't necessarily try and sort everything out straight away. Metta, when accompanied by a certain sort of wisdom, might mean leaving things until the moment is right. Wishing well is part of an awakening experience, which also involves understanding things. So it's not, you might realise, by bringing to mind a difficult person, you might find that you recognise that you can't do much right now to bring about a reconciliation. You're on the lookout for when that might be possible. But it might be time just to go to the forest for a bit. I myself had a very strong experience of this. I had a big falling out with somebody when I was 23. He went off with my girlfriend. Bad thing to do. She later apologised. But he never did. And I held that in my heart because I trusted this guy. I trusted this person for reasons which would make sense if I told you what they were. But he really let me down. And I'm not somebody who's had a very difficult life in that sense, I don't think. But I remember 10 years later on retreat, I was practicing metta bhavana. And I put him in the fourth stage, as I normally did. And I had this experience of something just giving way and letting go. And there was a sort of experience of forgiveness. Which, what that meant was, it was just time to let go of this particular event and just move on. And it's been very clear since then. You know, if I was to bump into this chap, I'd be perfectly friendly. And I regard that as a really positive aspect or outcome of doing metta bhavana. A sense of finding a sort of natural, allowing a process to occur of forgiveness, which took its own time, as it were, but I was on the lookout for it. I better wrap up because it's getting on, but I wanted to talk about the four stages in that way to give you a sense that each of these stages actually gives you an opportunity not just to practice metta bhavana, but to see aspects, to explore aspects of metta as freedom of heart in your experience, in towards yourself, a friend, a neutral person, a difficult spirit, difficult person. So metta, which ultimately means liberation of your heart or consciousness, is not something that is particularly, it is a very high ideal, and yet we can explore it in our ordinary lives, as it were, in ordinary experience by using these five stages. And in that way, we can gain the knowledge and experience to simply practice this pervading of all the directions. At least sometimes. Thanks very much. Mm-hmm.